31, 2002, at the Fresno Convention Center. Can you give us your full name?
My name is Gilbert Rivera Flores.
We want to talk to you a little bit about your early years. Where were you born?
I was born in Lemoore, California.
And when was that?
March 24th, 1932.
And your parents, were they born there also?
My father, Frank Flores, was born in Lemoore also. My mother was as an immigrant from Mexico, was born in the state of Jalisco.
And when did she come up?
Oh, they immigrated during the Mexican Revolution in the 20s.
Okay. 24. What kind of work did they do?
Oh, farm work.
Where, in Lemoore?
In Lemoore, in the Hanford area.
What fields, what were they picking?
Well, they were, most of the big crop that they did was the cotton. And the cotton's around Corcoran, and they involved in all the strikes that were, you know, it happened at that time. They were involved in the 1933 strike. It was the biggest that they had.
What can you tell us about that you know?
Well, I was a year old, a year and a half old. Yeah, but yeah, we were at this Peterson camp there in Corcoran, and I guess we people went on strike, and we were taken out of the camp, the ranch camp, and were put into a camp downtown Corcoran, sort of a concentration type camp. And and I guess my brother was just a few months old, and I was there. So, and after that, I guess that's where it came into my blood. Any strike or anything.
And how long were you there? Do you have any idea?
I don't have a slightest idea. Uh-huh. I mean, I think that the strike wasn't settled until probably 34, I think, early 34.
Okay.
There was a lot went on. As a matter of fact, a deputy consul, Mexican consul, was shot outside of Peak Street, walking out of a farm worker meeting, was killed by growers and highway patrol.
And this is still when you were very young?
Oh, I was a year old. So okay. I was in 33, 34.
And your parents' education and
my father, I think went to the ninth grade. My mother never went to school here in this country.
Okay. And so you grew up in that household, and what were your early years like?
Well, just, the first few years going to school, and then I quit when the ninth grade, because my parents had moved to Los Angeles, and I went to Los Angeles, didn't like it, came back, and went back, and quit school and went to work in the fields.
Did you come back on your own?
Yes.
What was that like? How old were you?
Well, I had my grandparents in Hanford, so I stayed with my grandparents, and working in the fields, and then suffering in the wintertime, because back in those days there was no unemployment insurance, there was nothing. It was just, you worked when the cotton ended, that was, that's it. And you waited until next spring to get back to work,
So you're about 15 maybe, you said, in the ninth grade or so?
I was about 13.
13. Yeah. What was that like to leave your folks down in Los Angeles?
Well, it wasn't, for me it wasn't hard, because I had actually been raised by my grandmother. So to me it was great getting back to Hanford to be with my grandparents.
So you left school and went working. What kind of work did you start to do?
When I came there, I did everything from grape picking, for raisins, cotton, and later years when I got older, I did cantaloupe, which was a man killer.
Why was that?
Well, because back in those days, you carried a sack on your back, and you stooped and you picked it up, like if you were picking cotton, except those melons are getting the more the bag got full, the more weight it had, and then when you went to empty, you had to climb up a trailer with a board that just buckled with your weight, and then dump it and go back and just keep running back and forth.
What time did your day begin? When did you start that?
We generally started about 6 in the morning.
And you worked until?
Well, and depending on what crop, like in the grapes, probably 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock sometimes.
And what was your day like? You started and just went right to the field?
Right to the field and worked, and whenever you got hungry, you ate, and then, in the morning, it just was the hardest. In the morning, you had to get up and make sure you had your water ready, because you had to carry everything back in those days.
Right.
There was no water in the fields, nothing. And Just you had to make sure that you had everything ready for that day.
You had to bring food.
Oh yes.
Were you allowed to take breaks to eat, or you had?
No. I mean, there was picking grapes. It was by piecework, so mm-hmm. you could anytime you wanted to. But when you're working by the hour, it was half an hour, which generally meant 25 minutes or 20 minutes, and you know.
Right. You could. So talk a little bit about the piecework. How much did you earn?
Well, back in those days, it was the piece rate was very big. I think if you went home with $5 a day, you were doing very well.
Have any idea how much you had to pick for that?
Oh yeah, well, if there was if they were paying 25 cents a box or 10 cents a box, quite a few boxes, 50, 60, and the peaches and the grapes. That were at that time when I was working in the fields, they were paying 5 cents a tray, and that meant that. Anybody, you had to make 300, 400 trays, and very few people that I knew could make, mm-hmm. That many.
How did you get that work? Was it easy to get that work? Was there competition?
Generally, most of our neighbors, had crews. They were, sort of crew pushers. They acted like contractors and charged you for taking you to work, and then they took care of you up in the field. Then, the employer hardly showed around, and he came around once in a while, but had these people to... keep an eye on us and make us work.
And what were they like?
Well, it depended. There's some people that were pretty nice. There's some people that never learned any manners, and they were very rough. It was very easy for you to get fired. They would tell you, you either work harder or leave. Or don't come back tomorrow. Or they would tell you, don't come back tomorrow. We don't need you anymore.
That ever happened to you?
Well, a couple of times, I think it was because I answered back. I guess I was always a rebel. I just didn't like it.
Have you, any circumstances of what they asked you to do that you talked back about?
Well, yeah, they just said, we were chopping cotton, and they said, cotton chopping was in Corcoran, and the Corcoran fields, I don't know if you know the area or not, but the Corcoran fields are miles long. The area of Corcoran is probably 20 miles. They probably plant cotton in a 5 miles, 8 mile row, and then they cut it up in mile long rows. And we had to go 1 mile, a mile back. No bathrooms, no water. And it's out in the open. There wasn't a tree around for miles. Yeah. And they said, just wanted to, we had a foreman that kept saying, move. Finally, I just got tired and said, I'm not going to work any harder. So he said, don't come back tomorrow. So. By next day I went someplace else, in the same area but with a different person.
So when you did that, were you the only person to do that? Did anybody else speak out, or were you a real lone figure?
No, I was probably, in my crews, I was generally the one that was,
And where did you learn that?
Well, I guess from my mother and my father. I said, I was raised in a strike family, and it's the people that, it was a strike, during the strike they were all involved, my grandparents.
Do you remember learning about, them telling you how to respond and what they went through? And you remember any of that?
Not much. My grandparents were very people that didn't want nobody to answer. My grandfather worked all his life in the fields, back in those days, of like pitching hay, and into carts and doing all the heavy work. And they never answered anybody. Their thing was, you do your work, and you don't answer because you're going to get fired. And to them, it was something that they didn't want to do. That's why it took so many years to really organize. Some of the older people never wanted any problems.
What were your grandparents' names?
My grandfather was Albert, and my grandmother was Duviges. We used to call her Vicky.
And where were they born? What do you know about
they
them?
My grandmother was born in Texas, and my grandfather was born in the state of Guanajuato, mm-hmm. Mexico.
And they came there to work?
They came. Most of them came during the Revolution.
Right.
Things were rough over there, so they left Mexico.
Uh-huh. So you started with grapes? And
I did grapes. I chopped cotton. I cleaned it. And then after years later, was sort of graduated into tractor driving and... but in the grape harvest, not far from here down Selma, about 13 miles south of here, all the people from my hometown, from Hanford, that was the closest grapes we had, so that's what we came to. And we did most of it. We picked them, then we turned them to make sure they dried on both sides, and then we followed up with rolling them and then picking them up and putting them in boxes ready for shipping, and you know, just followed them.
Mm-hmm. So in the case like where they told you not to come back, it was easy to get a job the next day, or it was hard to get
one? I think first few times it is, and I think the word gets around among them, and I think it gets a little harder. Mm-hmm. But you generally found work.
And how did you learn how to pick or like you said, turn them over? Did they teach you that, or you knew that? No, or
you have to learn on your own.
Right.
That's why people didn't show you anything. They mm-hmm. expected you, so you were a farm worker, you were expected to know everything.
So by the time you got to do the cantaloupe, which you said was the toughest, how old were you maybe at that point?
I was about 20.
So you're doing it maybe 7 years or so.
Yeah.
And where did organization come into your life in terms of, you know, talking with the growers and things?
Well, see, I guess back in those days, the CIO would send organizers, you know, and they'd come to the home to have a house meeting. And this happened all the time. They'd take your dues and tell, we'll let you know, we're going to start a strike. So I must have joined about 50 unions. I mean, the CIO about 50 times. About every year they come by, they're going to have a strike. And we just kept joining up, hoping something would happen, but generally never did.
So when they came, it probably didn't take much convincing?
No, it didn't. I mean, just wanted to, you know, it was, you know, cotton picking was very hard. You know, it was very hard.
And tell me what about that.
Well, you know, you had a 10, 12-foot sack, and you just, you know, on part, you know, bending over on your knees and just picking cotton and try to fill that sack up. And once you filled it up, you had to carry it, put it on your back and carry it. And sometimes, like in Cork, and like I tell you, in Cork, and sometimes the trailer could be, I don't know, a third of a mile away. And then you weighed it, and then you had to climb a ladder over this rickety ladder, and then you had to dump it and go back mm-hmm. again, and just trying to fill it up. And so it was, you know, farm work is not, you know, didn't leave a very good memory. You know, I mean, it's a rough memory that it mm-hmm. left. You know, I mean, but that's all it was, and what else could you do? You know.
And you were driven to work and driven home?
No, a lot. Well, sometimes we went with if it was a contractor, he'd take us and he'd charge us $1 something. And, you know.
But if you said $5 a day, so now you're down to $4.
So we split it with him.
Right.
Yeah.
And also to get home, how did you get home?
Well, they took you, and mm-hmm. then we had to wait until, if we went with a contractor, we had to wait, you know, sometimes 6, 7 o'clock at night, and when everything was done, then when he was ready to go home, he'd take us home, get home late, and straight to bed sometimes, no dinner or nothing, too tired, you know. Just you had to be up early in the morning again. So.
Right. So one meal a day, lunch or?
We had lunch, you know, sometimes, you know, breakfast at home, or not very rare breakfast, but lunch.
And they didn't have restrooms, you had to bring your own water.
Had to bring your own water, restrooms wherever you could find before nobody was looking.
Mm-hmm. So do you remember when an organizer first came to your house and asked you to join? Do you remember the first time you paid dues?
No. I must have been about 16.
Do you have any recollection who that was that came?
No, I don't have a slide. He just came, and I was looking at I have a button collection for the union from the UFW, and I was looking and remembering that they did, and they gave us a button. Every time it was different. Sometimes it was yellow, sometimes it was light blue, sometimes it was pink or something like that, and had your dues paid for 3 months, and but that, you know, then you'd never see them again.
Oh, okay. And what were they telling you was good about organizing?
They were organizing a strike. Generally, all that at that time it was all against the cotton industry. Everybody was trying to organize a cotton industry, but at that time Boswell and all these big growers in Cork were very strong. It wasn't going to work.
Did you have any fear that if they came to your house, people were watching them, or they knew where they were coming?
I never had a fear. You know, we just to us it was an adventure to get out there.
Uh-huh. So you remember how much the dues were when you first started paying?
I think it was 50 cents a month.
And you said they never came back.
We never saw them. You know, some we never seen them. We never saw the strike either. You know, so it sort of made you leery of organizers.
Okay, and then you said other people kept coming back?
Yeah, they're different organizers, you know, a year later or some other time, and we kept falling for it, and, you know.
Well, you probably asked some questions, though, I would
think. Oh, yeah, well, we asked, you know, what happened the last time? Well, this thing happened, and we didn't get to do it. So now this time we're going to do it. But it's just, I guess we never got smart enough to really say, wait a minute, when is this really going to happen? You know.
But you tried it.
Yeah. But then I think they're coming around about 4 or 5 years, and then they quit. You know, I guess they finally figured it.
But then it began to work at some point.
I think the only time it began to work is when Caesar started.
And what can you tell us about your involvement and where you met him?
Well, I was in CSO, the organization he was working for before, and his dream was of having a union, and the CSO at that time was made of Hispanic lawyers, businessmen, and office workers, and you know, just general people, and they didn't care. You know, they were no longer working in the field, so they didn't care. And so Caesar kept asking, and they wouldn't, you know, do nothing for farm workers. Until finally, I can't remember what year in Calexico, he gave him a license, an ultimatum. You know, you either go help the farm workers, or I quit. So we walked out of the convention, CSO convention in Calexico. And a few months later, we organized the NFWA.
So when you began with the CSO, were you in Lemoore?
I was in Hanford.
You were in Hanford, mm-hmm. And he was in Los Angeles, or he had come up already?
No, he was in Delano.
Okay. And so take us kind of from there to Calexico. How did it all come about?
Okay, well, I was just hanging around with the guys, and then finally these two guys, Gilbert Padilla and Tony Orendain, which were two of the originals, came by and said, you know, we're going to have this guy named Cesar Chavez come down. You know, it's got this organization, CSO, and I had heard the name of CSO in San Jose, because at the time he was in San Jose. So, you know, it was funny because I went to this meeting, and I had heard so much about him from everybody was talking about Padilla, about Caesar, how great he was and how good he was already, and when, during the CSO days. So I went to the meeting, so I joined CSO, and I went to the meeting that he was coming to, just to see him. And the funny thing was that I was sitting there, and there was a gentleman sitting next to me with a big, heavy peacoat, you know. So, and then when Gilbert Padilla was the president of CSO at that time, so he said, well, I'm going to now introduce Cesar Chavez, and my eyes went straight to the door, and I expected to see this huge guy with a mustache, and, you know, big, heavy-set guy with a mustache, and, you know, finally expecting some guy like Pancho Villa to walk in the door. And instead, this short little guy with a peacoat gets up and walks to the front, you know, and I said, oh, my God, this is Cesar Chavez, and this is short, you know, so... After that, you know, we sort of became friends, and after we walked out of, you know, then we kept going to a few conventions, and then, and Caesar insisted at every convention, you know, we got to help the farm workers and labor contractors in the organization, but especially from Delano, they said no, and that's it. So finally, when we walked out, a few months later, Caesar sent us a letter and. Says I want to form a union. You know, we're going to have this meeting in Fresno. And so on September 30th, 1962, we met at Edison Hall, about a couple of miles from here. And that's when we formed.
And when are you talking? It was that you first met Cesar at that meeting?
Probably about 57, something like that, okay. In the 50s.
So once you stood up and started talking, what was your impression?
I was very impressed, you know, but at that time he was just talking about CSO. He was talking about more of benefits, and he wasn't talking about farm worker movement or anything of unionizing or nothing. He was just talking the regular, but it was it was there to help farm workers try to get, you know, like citizenship and all that, and give citizenship classes and everything. I think the biggest, you know, when I really, he impressed me the most, well, I guess impressed, I guess, because I was a little skeptical at the beginning when he first started talking about unions, because, I mean, the man was a dreamer. I mean, the guy came up with his dream, you know, and he was telling us at this convention here, you know, about what the farm workers were going to have someday. And, you know, and it was a lot of us that just said, yeah, you know. Of course, that's all we said, you know, and it's hard to believe now, you know, we see it, mm-hmm. You know, but what happened, but at that time, you know, to that time, I think it was just, you know, to us, it was just, you know, the man was dreaming, you know, but we followed him.
What had you been doing for the CSO up until that point? Were you organizing?
We just talked to people about joining CSO, you know, and getting people to take advantage of it, you know, get their citizenship, become citizens, you know, and you know, we help people with welfare problems back in those days and housing, you know, and anybody had a problem with, like, you know, any kind of problem, we just went to bat for them. Mm-hmm.
So when you left the meeting after he spoke, what do you remember doing or the following meetings?
Hanging around with Padilla and Orendain, the guys, the original ones, and whatever they did, they taught me how to, you know, he said, well, you're gonna be doing this for them, you know, we'll send you people, you know, people that need welfare or people have to be taken to the welfare department, the people that have to have something done for them, you know, we're gonna send them and you take them, you know, so.
And you were still working in the fields at this point?
Oh, yeah.
So you did this at night?
Well, I did this, or sometimes, you know, field work is not really constant back in the day, so sometimes I was home during the day, or they would let me know, and, you know, I'd either come home early or not go to work on that day or something.
And did you do any of this work in the fields, the organizing and talking to people?
Well, we talked to people, you know, about, you know, become citizens, you know, and we'd tell them, you know, any problems you have, you know. We didn't tell them about wage claims or anything at that time because, you know.
So you didn't get in trouble doing any of that?
Not, you know, as long as it was welfare or housing or something, nobody cared, you know. Mm-hmm. But if we'd have started organizing farm workers for a strike or something, we would have been in trouble. But we never, at that time, we weren't doing that.
So what were some of the instrumental things that happened that helped that dream come to reality?
Well, we just start talking to people and, you know, and start getting this, you know, you're dreaming thing from other people. And, you know, and the more they said that, the more we said, no, it can happen if you help, you know. So we start organizing farm workers.
When did you begin to believe it?
I think probably, you know, a few months later after, you know, I start seeing the dedication of this man, you know, like, you know, he was gone from home, and, you know, he'd pick us up, or, you know, we'd have some of those, I'll pick you up on Sunday, we're going to go to Sanger or something, and we're going to write, you guys are going to sit down and write letters, and we're going to have farm workers sign up so we can get unemployment insurance for farm workers way back in the late 50s. Mm-hmm. And that's what we would do, and you sort of start believing that, you know, and you start becoming like him, and, you know.
So between 57 and that September 30th meeting, were there any significant events that you recall that really propelled it to come about?
I remember we just started going, we went to a lot of meetings, you know, from California state organizations like the Fair Employment Practice Commission and all of that. And it sort of started bringing, you know, that there was something that could be done if we did it, and if we really got down to do it, and trying to get the government to do it.
Did you feel any momentum building? And each time you were talking to people, was it getting easier?
It was getting easier, but but at that time we were only getting that sounds like a good idea, and some people would sign up. You know, we start getting membership, so.
And going into the September 30th meeting, what did you expect there? How was it billed?
You know, I really didn't know what to expect, you know. I knew that he was going to talk about organizing a union. He'd been talking about it for years, and, you know, we just said, you know. But we got there, and there was a lot of people there, a lot of non-farm workers there, too. You know, they used to belong to the CSO that followed into this thing. Something covered on the wall with butcher paper, you know, and then during the meeting, everybody wanted to know what's behind that butcher paper, you know. So we just had the meeting, and we talked about, you know, how we're going to organize, and this is what we're going to do. What do you think about insurance for farm workers? And, you know, or the $350 they're going to pay for membership will entitle them to $1,500 insurance and all of this. And so we were just approving things and trying to form a constitution and all of that, you mm-hmm. know. So they start getting interested there, you know, we start organizing something. And then about in the afternoon, they said, well, now we need a symbol of some sort. So they took the butcher paper, and here's the eagle, you know, for the first time. It's the first time we ever saw that, you know. And I tell you, some of the middle class guests that were there, we didn't know what to do, you know. They think that they were going to raise their hand Heil Hitler or some kind of thing, because they looked at it because of this black eagle standing there. They didn't know what to do. And they were really, you know, really astonished. And so some of them just kept looking, didn't know what to say, you know.
What was your reaction?
Well, I mean, I didn't know what to say, you know. I'd never seen anything like it. I mean, it looked like an eagle, but it wasn't an eagle, you know. So, I mean, what is it, you know? And then all of a sudden, this black thing standing right there, you know, this huge thing.
They explain it?
Yeah, they said, you know, something about the Sphinx, like a phoenix rising from the ashes.
Uh-huh.
What's a phoenix, you know? So there was a lot of farm workers there didn't know what a phoenix was. In fact, I didn't know what it was. And Caesar, you know, explained it. So it was a very interesting meeting.
Did they tell a story about putting it together? Coming up with that symbol?
Well, all I knew is that I think that Caesar told his brother Richard and his cousin, Manuel Chavez, to draw something, do something, you know. I guess they sort of forgot and went golfing. And that night, I guess, it just took them about 20 minutes to think of something. That's what they came up with. And the next morning, they had to have it ready.
They went golfing?
They went golfing. Manuel and Richard went golfing. And Richard wasn't a farmer. Richard was a carpenter. And so they went golfing, and they forgot about it. And that night, they were working hard, so that's what they came up with. And that's how the symbol, not too much planning was done. They just came up with something like that.
I wouldn't expect golfing to come up in this discussion.
Yeah.
And did people vote on the symbol, or was there any action taken on that?
They said this is what the symbol's going to be like, and you know, everybody accepted it after, you know, what I mean, you know, that's the way it is, you know.
And so tell me more about that day, things that happened, how you felt.
Well, I can tell you it's very unlike today, you know. This morning we got here and there's bread and there's juice and everything. That day we took a collection of $1 a piece so we could send for bologna and bread to have lunch, you know. And everything, you know, everything is different now. I mean, back in those days, it was just, it was very, I don't know how to say it. It's just that we just come to a meeting, you know, and it seemed to be more than any ordinary meeting I've been to, any kind of meeting, there was all this paperwork, you sign in, you did this, and you vote on this, and, you know, you vote on that, and this is what we want, and you start talking about a constitution, you start talking about bylaws and everything, and it was very, very.
And so how did you feel when you came in today?
Well,
and saw all that?
Yes, I've seen this, you know. Well, you know, to me, I just figured that it's been a long ways from Sal Cipuedes in San Jose, where he came from, to Si Cipuedes, you know, now, you know, 40 years, you know. But, you know, I guess back in those days, you know, get out if you can, and I guess today we can say we did get out, you know. So
talk about changes that have come as a result of all the work.
Oh, changes like in the fields, you know, water in the fields, bathrooms in the fields, you know, the end of the short handle hole, and you know, like also the people with contracts, you know, that have medical plans and have different things, and it is very. It's so different. I mean, back in those days, I could tell you, back in the days in Cork, and mile-long rows, nothing there, nothing, but cotton was this high. You know, it was about 3-4 inches high. The women in, the majority of the crews in cotton fields were women. And we're talking about crews of 100 people, 80, 90 people. Most of them were women. Where could they go? You know, the men just stayed behind and turned around and that, you know. But women, sometimes they had to form a semicircle and take turns out there in the open. I mean, that's gone now. You have bathrooms. I think the only thing now is making them sure that they kept clean. But I mean, the changes that came. I mean, you know, the growers now have you know, breaks, and, you know, and deductions of, you know, for benefits, unemployment insurance and all of this. I mean, no, this has been, you know, in the last 40 years, there's been a lot of changes.
You want to break that?
One question before we break. Did you work with the court keeper?
I was in CSO.
No,
I mean, I was in CRLA.
No.
Oh, did I? Very, very, I think half a day. Mm-hmm. And sugar beets.
And the sugar beets.
Yeah. And forget it. I'm too tall for it anyway.
Yeah.
Okay, let's take a break and switch the tape. So, back to the meeting. You left there with the NFWA. Was it approved at that point?
Yes.
Okay, and what were you going to do after that? How did it proceed?
Well, every time I was elected first vice president for Kings County at that meeting, so I was the first vice president elected there, and then each county got a vice president. And our thing was to organize farm workers. I mean, at that time, not into a union, but more into something similar to CSO. They would have insurance, and that with the process would start. We start getting membership for a union, and so that's what we were doing. We were just talking to people and trying to get them into the NFWA. To, you know,
how did you become a vice president? Threw your hat in the ring?
No, they just I was just elected. I guess the other people figured they better somebody else do the work.
So did they know you? What was your reputation, so to speak, at that point?
At that point, I guess they were just electing. You know, just wanted somebody to be there. So, like I said, one of the people from my town nominated me, and they just went along with it.
Okay.
It wasn't that big of an election like this one here.
Uh-huh. And then, so you organized as a vice president and signed people up?
We signed up people in Hanford. Okay. We talked to them, and it was, you know, like I said, it wasn't an easygoing thing. People, you know, were, like I said, they were all used to the old-time CIO thing. And so trying to get people and then getting people, you know, what's going to happen if, you know, but, you know, because we told them this was the start of a union. We were trying to start a union, and that's what we were trying to do. And, you know, right away to them came, you know, union means a strike, and, you know. And then they keep saying, well, I got a family to support. And, you know. And so we're not going to strike right now. We're just trying to get it organized. We're just trying to get it, you know.
And where did you talk to them? Did you go to their homes?
And we went to their homes. We talked to them in the field sometimes. At lunchtime, we had lunch. You know, the foreman wasn't there. We would talk to them. And then, you know, a lot of us, if we had cars at that time, we would give rides to people to work, you know. Sometimes I would take five people in my car and I'd talk to them.
Aside from maybe not thinking anything was going to happen, did they feel a risk, any kind of danger?
Well, they felt that, you know, they found out, they might not get a job. It's always been that fear, and it still exists today.
And did it happen?
No, not to me. That never happened, you know.
Right.
And now, you know, during the last year that I work in the fields, I was, you know, pretty vocal about it in the field, and, you know, and my foreman knew about it. But matter of fact, I didn't go to work one day because I was having a fundraiser for Caesar in Hanford, and all it caused me was that I was taken off my job, and I had a sort of an easy job, and I was put back to work in the field to pick peaches, and, you know, but that's about all that happened.
So the pace must have stepped up a little bit because there was a strike about 3 years later.
Right.
What led to that? What can you talk about?
Well, the strike part is we got word, you know, that there was going to be a strike, and it needed everybody to come, Delano who wanted to come. So I stayed behind, and I didn't come to Delano to strike. Some of the other people from Corcoran, other people from Corcoran came. And Orendine and Padilla, the ones that trained me, came also. Mm-hmm. So they were the original that came to the union when the strike started.
Why was a strike necessary?
Well, it wasn't at that time. It wasn't the it wasn't us that started. It was the Filipinos. It was just a solidarity thing to help the Filipinos out, and because the union wasn't really ready to go. And, you know, the union didn't have any plans of doing anything for another year or two yet. But they went ahead and walked out, and so the union got, you know, backed them up.
What was your relationship with the Filipino union?
At that time, I didn't even know about it because I was in Hanford. We were stationed, we were in Hanford. Each one of us in our own county. And everything else was going on in Kern County, so we weren't too much aware of what was going on.
Okay. And then tell me about the strike.
Well, after the strike started, and I started, I got a job in Delano working for an attorney's office with California Rural Legal Assistance, which I'm still employed by them. And so then we all got involved, and, you know, before work, after hours, and before hours. I was constantly in trouble with, you know, accusations that I was on the picket line during my working hours, and, you know, and that I was doing this and that. So, you know, we had a lot of inquiries from the government because of my being involved with the union, but, you know, nothing ever happened.
Were you on the picket lines?
Oh, yeah. I would. I'd go at 4 o'clock in the morning with the rest of them.
Do you remember the first time you did that?
I'm probably in 1966 when I moved to Delano.
Uh-huh.
I was constantly on the picket line, and then I got out at 5, and I'd head out for the picket line, or, you know, union meeting. I was at every union meeting there was.
And more about the strike. How long did it go, and how?
In quite a few years.
And aside from picket lines, what other kind of activity was going on?
Well, and just the organizing, trying to organize outsiders, and, you know, getting food, you know, trying to get people to, you know, have fundraisers in your own hometown to try to get food to them, bringing Caesar to speak. And
what were some of the issues? What did you struggle with? Because they were afraid they were going to lose their jobs, and they weren't getting paid, I guess.
No, some of the people, like in my hometown in Hanford, didn't feel that it was going to go anywhere, that it was going to be another thing like before, and it was never going to work. You know, a lot of people in that town still remember the 33 strike, that they struggled for a year, I mean, for months and months, and nothing ever came of it, really, you know, except a settlement of, you know, I don't even remember what it was, $1, 100 pounds, or $3, 100 pounds, whatever it was, mm-hmm. at that time. And they, to them, they didn't believe it. You know, they didn't believe anything was going to come out of it, and they weren't just going to jeopardize anything, you know, because it wasn't going to happen. They were, and, you know, they just didn't believe it. And the thing was that Caesar wasn't in any of these towns. You know, people in Delano believed him because he was there. They could hear him talk, and you listened to him, and, you know, you could probably convince anybody of anything. And he wasn't in these towns. And we're the ones that tried to organize, and it was very hard.
Did you ever have doubts?
You know what? I not really doubts. I mean, I just, I don't know, I was skeptical. I just didn't know. But to me, because Caesar didn't just have the strike, he had all these other dreams about what was going to happen. I could believe that maybe the growers would eventually cave in. But you know, I had, you know, doubts about the other things, you know. But, you know, like what he has today, you know. I mean, I had doubts about unemployment insurance ever coming to farm workers. You know. It seemed like an impossibility. And you know, bathrooms in the fields. I mean, that to me, just sort of, you know, and then that became part of my job as a community worker for California Rural Legal Assistance. My job was toilets, so I came back to Hanford after I moved, because I moved to Delano, and after that I came back to Hanford with a vengeance. And all the places where I worked, that was the first people I hit. You know, I knew they didn't have toilets, so I.
So tell me about that. That was your job to begin supplying them?
My job was to see that farm workers, you know, were given bathrooms, because there was a law that said they had to have bathroom and water, clean water and everything. So I knew they didn't have them, so I just, you know, so.
How did that law come about?
Well, I think it was probably right after the union started organizing, some of the senators just finally got to it. I mean, somebody got there with a conscience, and they said, you know, people have to have water, have to have bathrooms. And
did you deal with any legislative issues like that?
I went to the legislature one time, I think when the late Senator Murphy, you know, was saying we didn't need anything. And I think it was a matter of the shorthand of hoe. He was talking about shorthand of hoe, and he said that, I remember he said that we don't need you know, the shorthand of Ho is good because Mexicans are all short. You know, so I remember I got up and said, which Mexicans are you talking about? You know, and he looked at me, and the poor guy was already sick on his throat. So he just didn't know what to say. But
and how tall do you stand?
6'7". I'm shrinking now. And but you know, but the thing is that he, you know, but that's what happened. And then when I went, you know, our attorneys were fighting for, you know, the law said you got to have bathrooms, you know, and so all these growers looked at me like, you know, where in the hell are you coming from? So I said, hey, you know, I know you don't have toilets, so you got it. And then we would get together with the labor commissioner, and we'd tell him this place, and we had a couple of good labor commissioners in Fresno, and they would pick us up someplace along the way, and we would take them to the places where there wasn't any, and they'd get cited.
Right, just because there was a law doesn't mean they were willing to do it right away. How did that play out?
We had to force them into it. I mean, we had to go to all these ranches.
And you'd meet with the owners?
Yeah, well, we wouldn't, the labor commissioner would. I mean, uh-huh. We'd stay in the car, you know, and then the water. Because, you know, we used to, where I worked at, we had beer cans with a wire on them, and, you know, everybody drank out of the beer can into, and then they kept putting into the old milk cans. I don't know if you know what an old milk mm-hmm. can looked like, then, you know, with, it was full of water, and then we just, you know, and the beer cans was a cup, and we just, you know, everybody drank out of it, you know, everybody, you know, so.
So you would round up the labor commission?
Yeah, so we would call the labor commission and say, you know what, we have this many complaints, we got all these complaints, and then we had one labor commission say, well, I'll meet you at 6 o'clock in the morning or 5 o'clock in the morning a certain day, and then we'd take him.
And then?
He would cite them.
He would cite them?
Mm-hmm.
And did that mean you could install toilets, or
well,
was there more to it?
They had to. They had, you know, they told you how to, you know, or else we're going to, you know, stop your cruise. So,
was the owner responsible for providing them?
Oh yes.
And how long might that take from a citation to the actual?
Well, I mean, all it would take is a phone call to. You know, I mean, at that time there wasn't too many manufacturers, but I mean, they sprung up pretty fast, so it wouldn't take very long.
So. Did you get reactions from the workers?
You know, the workers just looked at us like, what are you trying to do? You know, I mean, workers are very hard sometimes to comprehend. They look at us like, you know, what are you doing? You know, why are you forcing them? Maybe we're going to get laid off, or maybe they're going to cut our wages or something like that, you know.
And then what did they say after they had the water and the toilets?
Well, they looked at us. They didn't say very much. We hardly ever got to see any of them, you know. Mm-hmm. But like in Delano, people would come to the office and say, you know, well, I'm glad, you know, you were there. And, you know, now we have water, we have this. And then things start getting stricter, and then they had to have hand washing with soap and paper towels and everything. And that, you know, they just kept blaming. I guess all the time they were blaming the union for it, you know.
And there were a lot of growers where you had to do this?
Oh, yeah. Every grower, no grower had it. No grower had a bathroom.
Right.
You know, sometimes you were better off working for a small grower because you were out here where there was trees and everything around, you know, these small ranches. Like I say, in Corcoran, you know, the lake area is probably, I don't know, 50 miles, and there's just, you know, just nothing there. So the small grower, you probably had trees or, you know, a riverbank or something that at least, you know, you could hide or something.
Mm-hmm.
But they're the ones that resisted the most.
And you went on doing this for how long?
Oh, I think we did it for about 10 years.
Uh-huh. So the strike, back to the support for the Filipino strikers, you said it lasted a few years.
Right, well, until the UFW became the union.
And then how did it end?
Well, I think the Filipino union sort of disappeared.
Right.
Yeah, they sort of disappeared. I haven't heard anything more about them. And then the farm worker still pulled it.
Let me just stop this. Thank you. How did that come about? And what were the differences?
Well, I guess the AWOC was mostly Filipino. And mostly the old-timers were the ones that, you know, the old-timers were the ones that stayed around because the UFW took over the Filipino Hall, and they were running it.
Mm-hmm.
And And some of the young Filipinos were not union members. They would not go along with it. So we had quite a few Filipinos. The old timers were the union members that were, they stayed around with the UFW. Most of them, they're all gone now.
And what was the main change? But how, you know, what did the UFW mean when it came about?
Well, you know, they were trying to do the same thing, but I guess the Filipinos wanted their own. Since they were the ones that really controlled the grape industry, I mean, you know, they were the ones that for years and years are the only ones that really did that kind of work. And so they figured that they wanted probably their own union. At least the younger ones, I think, you know, didn't want to be with anybody else but themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So I think what might have happened, you know, I'm not too sure, but they probably dropped out and just let the old timers to stay in the UFW.
So talk more about your activities. You mentioned you're on the picket line. Yeah. What other kind of job actions were you involved with?
Well, then I did security. I was with Caesar wherever he went.
Being his security?
Right.
What was that like?
Well, it was fun. It was sometimes a little scary, I guess, but it was all right. We never really had any big confrontations.
Did he ask you to be his security?
Well, the head of security did. So I went every place with him.
Why do you think they chose you?
Probably my height.
And tell me some of the places you went.
Well, we were on Prop 14, Prop 22. We went all over the state of California.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we went from one place to another, and you know, part of our job was to see where the food was going to come from for all the security and all the people that were with us during that campaign,
mm-hmm.
and taking care of him staying. You know, we had to take turns staying up at night. You know, we were 24 hours a day.
Where did he stay when he was traveling?
A lot in seminaries and homes. And sometimes we stayed, and a lot of people would just tell him to stay at their home, so he had to put up with a lot of people, you know.
What kind of trouble did you encounter?
You know, not too many. We encountered some problems with some groups like militants, you know, they wanted to be security, and sometimes they were more hassle than they were, you know, being useful.
Did the growers ever hire people to bother you?
Just the Teamsters.
Tell me.
Well, you know, during the Coachella strike, you know, after the Teamsters, we had a lot of problems. Every time we had a picket line, they had these motorcycle gangs, these Teamsters, and we just had a lot of yelling and close encounters, and had a few stabbings, and you know, people getting beat up. And
you say that as if we all encounter that kind of thing.
Well, you know, I mean, we had encounters with them. I mean, we were on the picket line, and they wouldn't let us talk. They wouldn't even let us talk to the people because they jammed us with us bullhorns, and you know, and then try to attack us and then call us all kinds of names. And you know, and if somebody went someplace at night, you know, they were generally, you know, a restaurant or something. We had a priest up in Coachella, went into this restaurant bar that was there, broke his nose, and, you know, I mean, that's when we had some, you know, we didn't go out anywhere. When we were in Coachella with Caesar, we never hardly went out at night with him.
When something like a stabbing would happen, what effect did that have on you folks?
Well, we just, you know, the one stabbing we had, it just was ironic because it was one of their own. They just didn't recognize him and they stabbed him, and it was one of their organizers, and they stabbed him, Teamsters.
So that brought some irony.
The thing was that they seemed to have the law enforcement on their side all the time anyway, so you know, we got used to getting arrested. Fortunately, I was never arrested, but a lot of our people got arrested, beaten up, especially in Kern County. Kern County was really, really, really bad. And I don't know, have you seen some of the films of Fighting for Our Lives and all of that? You know, Kern County police beating up against young girls and gassing them and all that stuff.
And you were there?
Oh, yeah.
And what effect did that have?
Well, it, you know, just sort of give you a bad taste for law enforcement, you know. I mean, especially that in that county and the sheriff, you know, we still remember. And, you know, and as a city councilman, I have to deal with them sometimes, you know, but I still remember, you know.
And but the response was civil,
right? Yeah, we had
so
to.
I mean, was it unanimous? Where did people want to respond differently?
Oh yeah, we had a lot of people, you know, that didn't believe in the nonviolence thing, but Caesar kept pretty short, you know, was on that. I mean, you know, he talked about it constantly, and then his fast when some people started getting a little out of hand, and that's when he went on his fast.
And tell me what you can about that.
You know, the thing is, Caesar started his fast, but he never told anybody. It wasn't until a few days later that he started noticing, even his wife didn't know. You know, so then he'd tell us why, you know. And then,
what did he tell you?
Well, he said he was on a fast for this reason. People were getting out of control. We were having too much violence. You know, and his whole philosophy was that, you know, if any girl or son or anybody else ever gets hurt or something, the strike is going to end right there. You know, we will not have a strike. You know, so we were always moved that, you know, if you could yell at them all you want to, but nobody was to be ever hurt or anybody. You know, none of the growers' kids. And our kids and. We're having trouble with the girls' kids in school, you know. They kept attacking them and they kept telling them, calling them names and all that, especially Caesar's kids, you know. But they learned to defend themselves pretty well.
Sometimes if someone were to do that, you'd think they would go on a fast to affect the growers, to improve conditions. But he did it for his own organization.
Well, one time he did it for that because he thought people were getting a little violent, you know. We had some people there that didn't want to believe in the philosophy, you know, they just wanted to constantly get into trouble, so, you know.
What did you think of that kind of move? What effect did it have on you?
See, I'm a very good Catholic, but I mean, to me, I'm not too much into the fasting thing, you know, but he believed in it, and, you know, so we went along with it, but, you know, to me, I don't know.
Did you see it cause changes in the organization?
Oh, sure. You know, people, especially when you start seeing the way he was after the last days, you know, the man couldn't hardly move or anything, it sort of, you know, it got to you when you saw him, you know. And I think it did some changes. I think what happened, some of the people got out. They left the organization.
Was that good?
Yeah, in a way, I guess it was, you know, because I think you know, reality. I think not all of us really believed in the nonviolence. I mean, I guess I figured that if I ever got attacked, I was going to defend myself. I didn't care what, you know. Or if anybody ever attacked Caesar, you know, I was going to do something, you know. And so, you know, and one of the things was that no security guard was to be armed or nothing, you know. We just, you know. All we had was just to protect him, was, you know, try to protect him as best we can any other way. And to me, I wasn't a firm believer in the nonviolence, you know, but I never caused any violence, but I just, you know, and, you know, I don't know if I could have gone along with it. And that's what he wanted, total nonviolence.
As you went through all of this, what were some of the experiences that moved you and affected your life?
Well, you know, I think I saw his dedication, I saw his sacrifice, you know, but yet, you know, the man loved his family, I mean, you know, but he was, the way he talked to people, you know, I mean, it really got to, you know, like, I drove a lot for him, you know, and he would never tell you, you know, turn here, turn there, or, you know, or you're going too fast or something, because it was one thing he always kept He kept an eye on your speed, you know, when you were driving. He'd always say, I think we're going to turn there, you know, I think we should turn there, I think we should do this. He never directly gave you an order. You know, one time I was going to San Francisco, was going pretty fast, and he said, we're not in a hurry, you know, we don't have to really go there, you know, we're in a hurry, you know. So I have to pull back, but...
You know, so you spent a lot of time with him.
Oh, yeah, quite a year.
And you mentioned dedication. What else did you learn in that relationship?
Well, that you can do things if you really set your mind to it, you know. I mean, he, you know, he said, you can do this and you can do it. And, you know, and the things he did, you know, I think, I don't, you know, the things like, you know, like take for instance his dogs, you know, he really liked his dogs. I mean, he had these guard dogs and, you know, the way he, you know, he was towards them and, you know, and he would tell us, I don't ever want to be caught in some place where we're starving because you guys will eat my dogs, you know, because you guys are meat eaters and all of this, you know, there's that thing. And, you know, he had a very good sense of humor, but, you know, but you sort of, I don't know, you sort of, in a way, idolized the man, you know, just sort of, you know. He just had his way. I mean, the man was, just had a way of getting, you know, you could probably turn a non-believer. By the time you got through, you know, you'd believe. I think if he'd have told us, you know, probably just before he died, if he'd have told us, you know, the moon's going to come down and land on the 40-acre, we'd have probably believed it. You know.
What about him? Do you think did that? Was it what he said, or how he said it, or what do you think it was?
I think the way he acted, the way he said things, and you know, and sort of made you not doubt him. You know.
And as you began to see some of the effects that you had, how did you feel about that success?
Well, I felt that, you know, that he, you know, that he deserved to, you know, to have these accomplishments because he'd sacrificed a lot, you know, and that he, so that's why when he died, I was just sorry to see that, but really in a way because he didn't get to see everything he really dreamed of. You know, he saw part of it, but he didn't see it all.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so where the Union is today. Still a lot of controversy, but I mean, it's still a lot of, you know, everything we do is still in controversial. But
mm-hmm.
But I thought that.
Are there some other things that you would just use to describe where the Union is today? You mentioned some of the actual things in the field. Anything else? How would you assess the Union today?
I think the Union's a little different today than it was with Caesar. I think Arturo has a different philosophy and how he does things. I think Arturo's probably is, I'm going to get a contract, and I'm, you know, if I have to go in there probably at this hourly rate, I'm not going to fight to the end because I want this rate, you know. And I think Caesar said I want $8 an hour, and he would fight to the end to get it. And I think Arturo's probably a little bit different. I think Arturo's whole thing is probably get my foot in the door, and then I'll probably.
What are some of the things that still need to be done?
Well, I think we have to get back into the grape industry because they're having a field day. I mean, they're being left alone, and you know, and there's still a lot of pesticide, a lot of things out there in the fields that's still going on.
What is your involvement now with the Union?
I just go to the meetings. I've, you know, just a lot of it's financial sometimes, and if they need something or, you know, they want to, like, mark the marches. And,
did you march to Sacramento?
I didn't march. I came the last two days.
How was that?
Tiring. You know, you're used to sitting at a desk, and you're not used to this stuff, and it just gets a little tiring. But it's, you know, it's really, you get out there and you start meeting some of the old people that just, you know, all these people still recognize you, or you recognize or see some of the people you haven't seen for years. And you know.
Talk about some of them. Go back to Gilbert and Tony. And
well, I haven't seen Tony for years. Tony went to Texas, and you know, and his thing was that he's at odds with the Union. And Gilbert's here in Fresno. I had seen him once in a while and talked to him on the phone mostly, but he's also has at odds with the Union. And so,
what were your early activities with Gilbert?
We were in CSO. We were both in Hanford, and Tony also. You know.
Did you work closely together?
Yeah, we were always together. We, you know, and the mostly us three were the ones that went along with Caesar when Caesar wanted to go to Sanger, wanted to go someplace to organize people, or he'd send us. We were all very close at that time, and you know, but I don't, you know, to tell you the truth, I really never knew what happened.
In the split?
Yeah, and they just dropped out, and they all took different directions. I don't know why. You know, Caesar wouldn't talk about it, and I talked to Actually, I've talked to Padilla, but he's never told me, he wouldn't tell me. So I don't know what happened between them. They were the first guys to follow him. I mean, they were, among the first ones, they were the first at the meeting, the first convention, and then they followed him through the strike and everything, and they just, I don't know what happened.
Mm-hmm.
But I know Tony's in Texas, and I don't know what he's doing. I think he's tried to form his own union, and it didn't work. And Gilbert's here. Gilbert's sort of semi-retired. Him and I are about the same age or something.
He's here today?
I don't think so.
Oh.
I don't believe that he was invited.
Right. So tell us more. Did you want
to?
Sure. Oh, okay. Sticking with, some of the early days, the organizing with Gilbert, describe him a little bit.
Gilbert was, kind of hard to describe him, because back in those days he was, he used to be a dry cleaner, and he was always leaving his job there to go to the courthouse or do things. I mean, he was, unlike Caesar, he was more of a easygoing person. He'd just take off, and he was a worker. He'd go get it done, and argue, at that time, we'd just do what we were told to do, I guess, he would tell us, well, this was going to happen, and the man was pretty well versed on what to do. I mean, he knew a lot about welfare, and he knew a lot about everything, so, And at that time, he was also part of Hanford's junior JCs, and that's what we used to kid him about, being part of the establishment, and all of that. But as far as being a very powerful speaker, I don't think so. But I think that he could get people to do things. Sometimes I know some people. He would tell him about the, he'd talk to him. By the time he talked to him, he'd get him convinced that we weren't the bad guys. We were trying to help people.
Did he organize a certain way and you organize a certain way? Did you compliment each other?
We talked to people. I talked to farm workers, and he would talk to people that were in his, probably businessmen or people that he knew, friends that worked downtown, or in stores, or deliveries, and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
We had, at that time, a lot of the people that were following Caesar, and I know in Hanford, were people that had different kind of work. I mean, they didn't necessarily work in the fields. A lot of early supporters were people that worked in, like delivering clothes from dry cleaners, or doing, working in bars, or working in, stores or something, so.
Mm-hmm.
So Padilla could, sort of mingle with them better. He could really talk to them. Tony was more of a, he was in construction, and Tony was a very different person. He was a little bit more, get to the point, saying, well, this is the way it's going to be, but Tony would generally get a story involved in it, talking about, this is what we did last week, and we know it can work, we can know we can do this and we can do that. But generally all three of us, when Caesar would call, all three of us would be together and go with him.
Now, he was a full-time staffer for CSO. And what about you? Were you paid by CSO?
Oh, no, I was just a member.
Right.
Yeah, no,
where did you meet Dolores when she came in?
Well, Dolores, we met her when she was, we used to go to Fair Housing Employment, the Fair Employment Practice Commission meetings and all of that. And it's sort of, Dolores, I guess to us, Dolores was Dolores. And I mean, we sort of paid more attention to Caesar at that time than we did Dolores,
What was your impression of her?
I thought she was a very hard worker and, very, just a go-getter, man. I remember one meeting we went to in Fresno, and we were sitting there, we were waiting for Dolores, and Dolores didn't arrive. She was driving down from Stockton, and we were at the Hacienda here in Brenda 99, and all of a sudden this car stops along the highway, and this lady gets out. Here's Dolores running with her shoes in her hand and running from this car, running towards my car. Broke up in Manteca somewhere, and then so I had to hitch a ride. So this, but I'm here, you know. I mean, she was, you know, that's all kind of things we had. But she would show up. I mean, no matter, I mean, she'd find a way to get there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the way she's always been.
Now, did you work much with her, or you say you were
not too much? Well, you know, they were together.
Right.
But you know, I really have a lot of admiration for that woman. Yeah, that woman is, I don't know, the stamina she has. And I seen her in the hospital when she had her surgery. I thought she was dead, you know. And to see her on this march is amazing. It's amazing. But she always found a way. And one of the things about Dolores always seemed to want to save money for the union. I mean, I don't know if she ever took a salary or whatever she did or not, but I remember she was always in the poverty level.
So when you were on this march, I'm not sure when the last time was you marched.
Well, I marched last Saturday.
I mean, before that.
Oh, yeah, it was the second one. I marched on all three of them, but not.
So what kind of memories did that bring up?
Well, the first one, you know, I marched alongside of seminarian Jerry Brown, you know, seminarian then. And it was just, it was an experience to me, something new, you know. I'm walking, I mean, I just couldn't say, I kept thinking, what am I doing out here in the middle of nowhere walking, you know, walking to where am I walking to, why am I walking, you know, and what are people going to think? You know, we're out here in the middle of nowhere walking, and then, you know, and then that night it rained like crazy, and I said, what the hell am I doing here, you know.
The first time?
Yeah, the first
time. And when was that? Where did you march?
I started in Stockton. That was the first march. I started in Stockton. I was working at that time.
And what was the march about?
Well, it was the first one that they took when Jerry Brown, I guess, Governor Brown there from Granitin show up when he left. I mean, you know, getting to the point, I don't even remember what it was about, you know. And so I joined them in Stockton, and yeah, I marched the last few days there. And the second day before the end, that's when I marched with Jerry Brown, mm-hmm. the seminarian then.
And you started out wondering why you were marching.
Well, yeah, after I was marching, I mean, we kept marching along this thing, and I said, why are we walking? You know, why are we doing this? And why am I doing this? And then that night when it started pouring rain and no place, you know, just a porch, and we had no place to sleep, you know. And they said, well, what are you going to do, you know? So finally just got some people together. So why don't we just go over that motel over there and rent a room? You know, people were out there and, you know, and in their cars and, you know, some cars and nothing. And some people didn't get home, so they were out there in the elements. So about four of us got together and walked into this motel with ponchos on. The guy thought we were going to rob him or something, you know. Everybody was, at that time, probably you get poor Hispanics walking in there, man, with ponchos on them, so, you know, or their face hidden, wondering what they're going to rob you or something. So we, you know. But you just kept wondering, I guess all of us kept, what are we doing?
And what answer did you arrive at?
Well, I guess I just arrived, we're just following something, we're going to, you know, we want to get something done, and that's what, you know. I started listening to the other members, the other people were workers in the winery, working for Christian Brothers, the other two that were with us, and they started talking, well, you know, we have to get better working conditions, and you know, and they were affected that time by the union, and I wasn't. At that time, I wasn't working for anybody that the union was even going to come close to. At that time, they were under negotiations with Christian Brothers, so that's the more made me think, what am I doing here, you know? And so I think that maybe for a long time I still had, you know, you had some doubts, you know, at least, you know, wonder if this is going to work or what's going to happen.
And the second time you marched, did you also wonder why?
No, the second time was already been a long time, and I already knew, and I had already been with Caesar through, you know, with all that security thing and everything, and I'd been in the picket lines and everything, so I more or less knew. And my wife and I both marched on that one.
You knew that you could make a change, or what did
you
know?
Well, I knew there was already a change, you know, had been done, and I think this was just the... to show the people that we were still around, that we really weren't dead as people thought we were, you know. that the union was still alive. And, you know, he was, and he was gone already, so it was just sort of another memory march, probably in memory, mm-hmm. you know, his mm-hmm. memory.
Who do you think that march is important to? The people marching, the people watching, or the people who they, you know, the legislators who they try to...
I think that the people that are watching, the people that are looking at you, saying, you know, what can there be out there? These people are really getting out there and really doing this, you know. And I think it affects legislators. I think it has some effect on some of them. Mm-hmm. I don't think it has them on all of them, but I think, you know, the people willing to get out there and sacrifice.
Let's talk more about the early days of the UFW. What were you doing when the transition came? Is that, that's after you were in the VP and installing mm-hmm. All of that. What were you doing?
Well, see, after that, when the NFWA became UFW, all the positions that we had were, you know, we no longer were vice presidents. I mean, they had their, you know, they had our own board at that time. So we were just, they were just waiting for us to come over here and help them out. You know, we would come with food, or we would, you know, we would just show up and, you know, go picket with them, or, you know.
And you were still working the fields?
Yes, at that time I was.
And you're just doing the same kind of stuff? Anything mm-hmm. different?
No, I was out there. I was organizing, yet when I came to work for California Rural Legal Assistance, I was still working there. As a matter of fact, Caesar didn't want me to leave Hanford, but he said he can probably do more work here than he can in Hanford, you know, so. Because Hanford was, you know, Padilla knew Hanford was a very rough town, very tough town to organize.
Because of the growers?
I don't know if there was a growers or the people themselves just didn't want to get involved. And it's still that way today. Mm-hmm. Even though probably if I go there, probably the only family I know would be my brothers, because I think Hanford is totally, completely been, you know, a lot of new people and everything. Mm-hmm. And the same people we have in Delano still don't want to organize. Mm-hmm. And they probably are scared of it.
Is the message the same as it was, you know, 30, 40 years ago? Or is there a new message? Why it's important to get involved?
I think people should be, I think a lot of people have seen it, you know, that it is good to get involved, that something has been done and there's been a lot of changes. And people will tell you, you know, thanks to him we've got a lot of changes, but you still can't get them to, you know, you can't get them to openly, you know, go to meetings. That's why we have meetings now. We're starting meetings again, and very few people go because they're still scared that somebody's going to see them at a meeting and going to go tell their boss.
Do you see differences in the people who are working in the fields now? Because obviously that's, you said that is the same. Are they different kinds of people, or are they the same kind of people?
I think most of the people now are strictly from Mexico.
And before?
And before you had a lot of American citizens, a lot of people from here, mm-hmm. you know, like me, myself, my brothers, right. Everybody was here. And now it seems like the majority, I think the majority, like in Delano, are all from Mexico now, they're all mm-hmm. migrants.
So how, what do they feel that, or think that's different? Are they just not as knowledgeable about what there is to offer?
Well, you know, they hear a campesina every day because they're allowed to have radios in the fields and they listen to them. But the fact is still that they don't want to get involved because they, you know, they feel they're going to lose their job. They're still afraid of the growers. I mean, the growers are still the biggest employers we have. So, like in Delano, they just don't want to get involved. You know, we have some people getting involved, but in general, the people that are getting involved are the people under contract. You know, people that are under contract are the ones that go to the meetings. Most of the people, other people that are working in the fields right now, like in the grape fields in Delano, you're not going to get them to a meeting.
Right.
Unless they were members, they're members from a long time ago, and they don't care, you know.
Right. Are you able, they know, do they see the benefits that they, the some of the conditions
oh, sure,
are a little
sure.
better than,
oh, yeah.
than before?
Yeah, of course.
What do you think their toughest challenge is now in the fields?
The pesticide.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they got to work. I mean, so they just, you know, And they see somebody get sick, and right away to them, everybody gets sick in the field, it's pesticide to them. They got this understanding that they think everything is happening now, maybe. You know, I don't know if everything is pesticide or not, but, you know, but they feel, well, you know, it's, you know, right away they come up with, you know, a man's been working for years, and, you know, it's probably pesticide, it's probably this, it's probably that.
Was that an issue that you used to deal with?
Well, we deal with it, but, you know, we talk about it, but, you know, because it's been my experience that there's not a doctor around that's going to really rule it as pesticide. You know, doctors would not say it's a pesticide poisoning, you know, so.
Even when they identify cancer clusters?
Sure, oh, sure. Yeah. I mean, the McFarland thing is still a mystery.
Mm-hmm. But it's not a mystery to you?
No, I don't think so. To me, I just feel that I don't believe that my feeling has always been along that I don't believe that the cancer cluster there in McFarland was due to the property. You know, they blame the where the houses were made. I don't believe that. You know, my feeling has always been that those houses were filled with people that lived in ranches and all moved in there and bought homes. So the cancer was already probably from where they were coming from. And they just happened to get all together, meet, and it just happened, the cluster happened.
So you mean they're blaming on the materials that
Well, they're blaming it that used to be a dump sites there during the Second World War. People claimed there were stacks of drums piled there. And what happened to the drums? They're probably buried under their seeping, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I sort of believe that all these people came from ranches, you know, were living in camps or living in ranches, and they just happened to all end up in the same place, buying homes in the same place, because it opened up, a new project opened up, and I feel that my opinion was always in, and I testified to that when they went over there, that I felt that that's what it was. But one lady said, well, you know, that's something to think about, but it's still a mystery.
You testified in court?
No, I testified in one of those hearings that they had, you know, and they, and you know, they said, well, that's you know, something to think about, but you know, they don't. It's never gone anywhere. Mm-hmm. And they'll never will. You know.
How long ago was that hearing?
Oh, about 10 years ago, I think. 10, 12 years, I'm not even sure.
Okay.
But, you know, they had them for days. But it's always gone back to the contaminated land.
So how long did you work in the fields?
Since the age of 5.
And when did you stop?
66.
Mm-hmm.
I worked in the field about 30-some years, 30 years.
Do you remember your first day?
No, I remember what we used to get out of school in June, and next day we were on the way to the coast.
Now, you said 5, so you worked with your folks?
Oh, yeah.
And you just went along?
Oh, yeah, the day after school was out, we were on our way. We were on our way to Hollister, Gilroy, San Juan Bautista, San Jose, mm-hmm. and didn't come back until September. So we were migrants back in those days.
And one brother?
There was 9 of us in the family, 3 died, 6. So now we're down to 5 living brothers.
Mm-hmm. Did the others work in the fields?
All of us work in the fields.
Uh-huh. Do you remember your last day?
Yeah. I was working in Selma doing a packing raisins, you know, and I got the job offer, so I took off.
Which job offer was that?
It was California Rural Legal Assistance.
Okay. So you weren't doing that while you were working in the fields?
Doing what?
Working for the legal assistance.
Oh, no.
Uh-huh.
I got the job in September of 66, and I left.
Uh-huh. So if you didn't get the job, would you have just continued to work?
I would probably still be in the fields.
Uh-huh.
Or I'd probably come gone to the union, but I wasn't too much at that time. I had a brother to support at that time, and a mother, and you know, my father wasn't too much of a help at that time, so I just, you know, so for me it would have been very hard to go earn $5 a week. That's probably one of the reasons I just didn't follow through like Padilla and the rest of them.
Mm-hmm. So the legal assistant made you an offer you couldn't refuse?
Well, they just gave me a job out of the fields, and you know, so.
Had you ever tried to get a job out of the fields?
No.
No. And was this something that you sought, or they found you, or?
No, but I was. I think they talked to Gilbert, and Gilbert called me.
Uh-huh.
And so I went. So I figured, you know, but then because they said, well, you'll be doing the same thing, you know, probably when we're doing the CSO, doing welfare work, and you're going to be doing this and that, so.
And you said you're still doing that work?
Oh, yeah.
And is that what you're doing, helping people with immigration and welfare?
We don't do immigration. We do most, right now we do a lot of landlord-tenant because Delano is a mecca of substandard housing. We have a lot of rat holes. And try to do that in the city council also. So,
what made you run for city council?
Well, I think one of the things was that I just didn't like the way the city was being run. And then I figured that it was about time somebody from the union, you know, they would speak freely about Caesar up there in the union because I can't get the other four members to do it.
Why do you think that is?
Because they just want to hold on to their, you know, positions and, you know. I'm the only one that speaks about the union and everybody knows where I came from, so.
And why are they against the union?
Well, I don't, you know, they feel that they don't want to get it, they don't want the growers against them, they don't want some of the people in town, businesses. You know, they don't want to be, they consider themselves to be popular, you know.
What did you learn with the union that helps you be a council member?
Well, I guess I'm helping it, making sure that my job would be to help everybody and not, you know, just certain people with money or position or something. You know, like I got him to name his birthday week, Cesar Chavez Week in Delano, and I got him to go along with it. They went along with it, so some of the growers weren't very happy about it, but I'm sorry, you know.
So I guess the question I would have is, after all these years, people have not come to recognize the value
not,
of
you
the
know
union?
What? Not in Delano. I think a lot of places you go outside of town, out of Delano, and you see a lot more being done for Caesar. In Delano, it's very hard.
Why do you think that is?
I really don't know. My wife is on the board of trustees of the high school, and she was instrumental in getting our new high school named Cesar Chavez. And we had, I don't know if you heard, but anyway, the grower sold them the property, and somebody discussed the name Cesar Chavez, and the grower found out and came, they put an addendum. You name it, or any, well, he made some racial remarks anyway, all kinds of racial remarks. You have to pay me $100,000. And they signed it. So it was named Cesar Chavez the other day, and the wife wrote the next day because he died. And he never got to see it named Cesar Chavez, but he made sure that if they named it any name other than what he wanted, they would have to pay him $100,000. And so she sent a letter wanting to know, when do I get my money? And that board won't fight it. You know, to me, it's discrimination, and to me, I think it's so important. Because he'd already sold the land. I don't think he had the right to tell him who to name it for. But you know, and it was a lot of, and there's been a lot of controversy. A lot of the teachers said they will not teach at that school. So I'm saying in Delano, it's still, the name Caesar still doesn't mean, you know, still means trouble. It means, you know, still a bad word.
Is that because he was so effective there?
I think one of the things is because they feel, some of the people feel that Caesar bought the town, you know, to bad light, that, you know, he put him in the map. I mean, he actually put him on the map. Nobody ever knew, you know. Delano was known for other things and wasn't known for that. So now it's known all over the world. But he doesn't, you know, they still, it's very hard. I mean, you hardly see people talking about him in public. Hardly anybody will mention his name.
That must be tough for you now as a government official not to have others embrace him as, you know, their own.
Yeah, well, I bring it up all the time. And, you know, there's always people. Sometimes I sort of joke about things like, for instance, the other day, one of the other councilmen said, we have trouble. We have a trouble with grade separation in the railroad tracks. And we haven't been able to get them to come and fix it, get Southern Pacific, you know, and PUC to come and fix it. So one of the councilmen said we have to, one thing we're going to have to get picket signs and picket Southern Pacific, you know. And I told him, you know what, that sounds like a good idea, but, you know, but civil disobedience and Delano, carrying a picket sign in Delano, and I said, you know, don't expect me to follow you, man. And everybody got a kick out. Everybody thought it was funny because they knew that I carried a, you know, sign for years and a flag, you know, for years, but, you know. But everybody thought it was funny that, you know, I was talking about civil disobedience. I said, you can't do that in Delano, you know.
But did you mean that?
No. I mean, and so everybody knew. I said, that, you know, I knew sure nobody's going to sit in front of that train with a picket sign. I mean, he's going to go right through you anyways. I said, no. But I was just joking with other councilmen, and then later on, then he said, oh, you guys, but, you know, he said that because you know he was Cito Chavez's bodyguard. I said, thank you. Thanks a lot. There goes my election, my re-election. So.
But in your experience, is it something that you would encourage?
What? Sure. I mean, you know, if that's the only way to get something done, it's the only way it's going to be. And I try to instill that in my grandkids, and this is very hard, very hard. Mm-hmm. You know, the kids that we don't have trouble with, I mean, I've been instilling this with Cesar Chavez, is the young kids from Mexico. I mean, those kids are very, very easy to pick it up.
To pick up?
I mean, you know, the name, the Cesar Chavez thing,
uh-huh.
They read his history.
Uh-huh.
And, they'll go along with it, but some of our American citizen kids just don't, I guess it's the parents at home, you know. That, you know, just to them, to a lot of people, some of his friends, a lot of his friends that he was raised with, that he hung around with, you know, I mean, just sort of moved away and they, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That, but he did a lot. He did a lot for that town. He put them on the map. He did a lot. A lot of people know. And I think there should be something there that would attract attention, you know, but... people come by, still see the 40 acres and all of that, but, you know. But otherwise, I mean, it's the grower still. We now have a priest in Delano who just, outside the church, put a monument with Cesar's name on it and dedicated a flagpole. And he's, so that ended all the growers' money coming into our church. But it's all right. You know.
Do you think that'll ever change?
I don't think so. I don't know. You know what? Maybe the new generation of growers takes over. Maybe some of the kids are a little bit less, you know.
Has that transition already occurred? It's the sons and daughters?
Some of the growers, but, you know, see, what's happened is that most of the growers have moved out of town. I mean, the young ones have moved to Bakersfield. And I don't know, maybe eventually, you know, one of the things is that we've had an exodus of Anglo in Delano. I mean, Delano is probably 90% minority now.
Mm-hmm.
It's probably about 10% Anglo population.
90% Mexicano?
Probably Mexicano and Filipino,
uh-huh.
Minority.
Right.
And they just start taking off to Bakersfield, you know, you know, and the growers, of course, live out in their farms. So, but they still try to control the town.
Right.
You know.
So, what are some of the things that have given you maybe the most satisfaction in the work you've done?
Well, I've seen. You know, one of the biggest things, my thing, is to have it, making sure that, you know, glad that they have bathrooms out there. And drinking water. Because that was something that we had to go through that wasn't very good, is drinking out of the same cup, having all these people. Especially on Monday mornings, man, when everybody had a rough day on Sunday. And, you know.
It's probably hard for some people to believe that those basics are something that had to be fought so strongly for.
Oh, yeah. I was still working in the fields when Jesus started, and he was talking about bathrooms and, you know, individual drinking water, man. And some of the guys says, "What is he crazy? What do we mean?" You know, why is a girl going to pay for all this stuff? You know, we've been drinking like this. What's wrong with drinking like this? You know, and they didn't care. And some people just didn't, you know. But it is, but that's something that is, I am glad, and especially the bathroom because of women. I mean, the women really suffered in those days. I mean, they suffered the most.
Mm-hmm.
Farm work has changed a lot now. You know, you go all over, you see bathrooms all over, huh? You see water, hand washing facilities. Unless you stop, though, sometimes you don't know whether those things are full of water or not. I mean, actually, you know, hand washing, you know.
Right.
But people have to, you know, the union's trying to educate them and say, you know, you got to wash your hands. You don't know what, you know, but you've been using them in the fields. I mean, you got to wash your hands. You got to dry them. You got to do this. And,
mm-hmm.
And some people still don't understand why. You know, why do I have to do this?
Have you ever